Welcome to Sacred Legions. I'm Max Goller.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
And we have a unique podcast today. We are actually sitting in the downtown Des Moines store of...
Yeah, you are currently sitting inside the greatest store in the universe, Raygun.
So, and we're here with Mike Draper.
Yep.
I wanted to interview Mike because I was doing a Comic-Con somewhere, and I was talking about an interview that we did in the past with Chris Cluey, and someone said, oh, have you heard of this t-shirt place called Raygun T-shirts? They've got some Chris Cluey t-shirts and they're magnificent. And I'm like, I've never heard of this. This is fantastic to me. And so we talked about it and I immediately went home and Googled Raygun t-shirts and read the story about Raygun t-shirts, which excited me immensely. I've got a son that went to U Chicago. Mike went to UPenn, an Ivy League school. And it was something that I thought, this is magnificent. And even more so, your role involved with the labor and the way that you run your business was truly exciting to me. So can you tell us about Raygun, how it got started? And
Well, hang on a second. One of the things is, the reason you're on the show is because you're a secular saint, right?
Oh, yeah.
So this is the Kurt Vonnegut description of a secular saint, as someone who lives decently in an indecent time.
Yeah.
And from your history, which we are excited to hear, you're a scrappy guy who tried to make decisions. But every decision you made, it appears, you tried to have the least negative impact on the people around you that you could.
Yeah, I mean, it all kind of gets back to kind of like why you're doing it. So I grew up in Des Moines, more or less. I was born about 6 blocks from where we're sitting now. So geographically, I have not come very far in life. I've only made it like half a mile. And there's a funeral home between here and the hospital. So I could go cradle to grave in one tiny stretch of the east side of Des Moines, which I don't know if that's an accomplishment, but it's certainly a good icebreaker for my funeral. Yeah. Grew up, like went to a high school right outside Des Moines, K-12, graduated. My main goal living here was to leave Des Moines, which I did. Went to the University of Pennsylvania to study history. And you start out and you're not really sure what you want to do. But my main thought was like, well, I just want to go make a bunch of money, and got to Penn. And the nice thing about Penn, by far the most educational thing, was you realize that like making a whole bunch of money really isn't that difficult. It's kind of like Bonfire of the Vanities. You just go where the money is and take a small percentage of all the transactions.
Right.
Now, once you're up close to it, then it's a decision of, well, do you want to be in corporate law, corporate consulting, or corporate banking for the rest of your life? And then I start thinking, well, not really. And I had always wanted to do something creative. When I was in high school, I played in bands. When I was in college, I was in bands. When I was in high school, I wrote for the Alternative Weekly in Des Moines. So I did movie and music reviews. It's kind of like a Des Moines version of Almost Famous, the movie. And my parents, my dad's an attorney, my mom's an engineer, had always said, like, well, how do you make, you know, money doing that? Which is a good question to answer. You know, it's a good question to ask. It's kind of like in It's a Wonderful Life when his guardian angel comes and he says, well, I'm here to help you. And he said, you don't happen to have $45,000, do you? He's like, we don't need money in heaven. He's like, well, it sure does come in handy down here. So it's not everything, but it's a good thing to think about. And a friend suggested that we start selling t-shirts my senior year at Penn. And we just stood outside of our house in the middle of campus. And I sold t-shirts to people walking by.
We're not Penn State.
Yeah, not Penn State was the first shirt.
Because I live in Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, everybody thinks Penn is Penn State.
Well, yeah, you get way more of that in Iowa, too. Nobody has really, you know, the Ivy League's not really pulling a lot of weight in Iowa.
Well, it's football, not, right? You got Penn State is football. Yeah, so you figure it's not football.
Yeah. And I mean, the Yale Club in Des Moines is not particularly active. So there's not a whole group of like Masters of the Universe running Des Moines. It's all Iowa and
so
Iowa.
So Donald Trump's time at UPenn didn't all of a sudden put it on the map in Iowa?
Yeah. No, it's still, yeah, not a lot of name recognition. So we started selling t-shirts and the thing that clicked was, oh, this is a creative endeavor that I can do totally by myself. I don't need to rely on other people in a band. I don't need to go through editors like you would with writing. I can just have shirts printed and then I'll show up and sell them. So I started traveling around out east, would sell t-shirts on college campuses or particularly busy intersections. So Times Square, Union Square, Columbia, NYU, Harvard, Yale, that type of thing. And then...
I just want to know the logistics. If there's a young entrepreneur out there who's thinking, I could do that. Did you start and you'd make 12 t-shirts? If they sold, you went home and made 12 more? I mean, how did it happen?
Yeah, at the time I was having other people print them. So I would order maybe 70 shirts and I would show up in a bag and just stand there and sell them. And you'd sell maybe, 10 one day, 12 the next day. So in about a week, you could probably sell 70 shirts. But I was just staying with friends, so you don't have a whole lot of expenses. I would just drive to New York, stay there for 2 weeks with friends, drive to Boston, stay there for a week, and then I would just park my car, stand on campus, and sell shirts to people. Literally the hardest thing about it was just taking about 750 steps back pride-wise that they had just, I just spent 4 years getting an Ivy League degree, and then I was selling t-shirts on the street.
How about your parents? How was their pride?
Yeah, that was the number one thing I got all the time. Because when a friend, I was thinking of what to do, and I thought, well, I should start making the shirts myself. I should open a store. I didn't really see a path to do that out east. And a friend of mine who was in New York at the time from Des Moines said, oh, you should just move back to Des Moines and put a store on the east side by the Capitol. They're renovating buildings. And everything kind of clicked in my mind because I thought, a friend of mine from high school, his dad had a screen printing shop in the pole barn behind his house, and he printed all our school's t-shirts. So I thought, I could just learn how to screen print from him. I could move into my parents' house, and then I could open a store, and my niche market would be ultra-positive slogans about Des Moines. So the whole thing seemed so clear to me that I just drove back to Des Moines and did that. I moved into my parents' house, started screen printing with my buddy, bought the equipment, opened the store about 6 months later in the fall of 2005. And now...
And you had handmade every shirt.
Yeah. And so to your question of what did my parents think, I got that all the time. Because I graduated with 30 kids from a small town, was the only person to ever go to an Ivy League school. And then, 5 years later, I'm back living in my old room, in my bunk bed, screen printing in the basement. And so all of my friends who knew me were like, oh, my God, what do your parents think? And if they had an opinion, they'd literally never shared it with me. I think they were kind of like, yeah, we'll see how it goes.
That's great.
I mean, it was my dad who first suggested that I, stop going to school. When I thought, oh, maybe I should go to law school. And my dad's even a lawyer. But he said, well, just stop going to school for a while. You can always go to law school later. Just graduate from Penn and then do literally anything else. Just for a year. So that was kind of the only direction I got. And opened the store, and it was just me for almost about the first 2 years. So the original store was a block from where we are now. So this store that we're inside has a coffee shop and a bookstore inside of it, and it's about 10,000 square feet total. Whereas the original store was about 1,000 square feet, so just kind of the size of this mezzanine. And it was me with a single, palette, forehead, screen press, a computer, a screen dark room, and then the store.
Now, you mentioned that you were doing ultra positive messages back then, which is something that is attractive to me for Sacred Legions, because that's, I was having ideas about, I want to do something related to Kurt Vonnegut, and there's all kinds of things I could do, both positive and negative, but it's I want positive messages out in the world, especially right now, positive messages. Sounds like you were doing the same thing when this first started. So what were some of those messages and why did they resonate with
your
you?
First
I mean, yeah, positive, but also kind of ironic humor. The idea was that Iowa, in terms of, somebody like Vonnegut, you think to yourself, the Midwest always, it doesn't think of itself as a funny region. But this is the region that's produced not only somebody like Kurt Vonnegut, but Mark Twain, Johnny Carson, David Letterman, essentially most of the original cast of Saturday Night Live coming out of Second City in Chicago. Yeah. Most American humor is from the Midwest. So it's a really kind of, you see it a lot with both Letterman and Carson, but this kind of self-deprecating, but also biting. It's like this kind of odd, Gene Shepard was a writer out of Indiana who wrote the story that became the movie, The Christmas Story, which gets played 24 hours a day on TNT. And he commented that the Midwesterner is a born audience member, that when you grow up here, you're used to kind of observing the world from a distance. So all life is happening on the East or West Coast. And you kind of bring that sense of observation to kind of everything you do. So there's a self-deprecation built into the humor because obviously you've never been the center of attention growing up here.
Yeah, the flyover states.
Illinois, yeah. And so one of our first shirts was Iowa, wave the next time you fly over.
And you don't
really know who the joke is on. Is it a joke on Iowa for being a flyover state, or is it a joke for people who think that all there is space to be flown over? But another one, like Des Moines, hell yes. The joke is built into it because obviously I lived in Des Moines, liked living there, was excited about Des Moines. But nobody should be that excited about Des Moines. If you saw somebody wearing the shirt, you would think there's got to be a joke. Or my personal favorite was Des Moines, let us exceed your already low expectations. So you'd have people who would visit and are like, oh, you know, it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. You're like, thanks. I live here. Also not as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Well, it's interesting you talk about that, too, because I am in Indianapolis now, and I retired from the Navy in 2001. And it was like, maybe we should stay in Indianapolis. And I was like, I can't do that. I can't do that. So I moved to Boston. I couldn't afford to live out there anymore, so came back to Indianapolis. So now I'm back in this black hole of Indianapolis. But it's... as it starts to grow in you, you realize there's really nothing in Indianapolis that you're going to find anywhere else that's any better.
And I mean, it depends on what you want. If, you know, when I, you know, you think about Des Moines and I live in like a pretty nice neighborhood. My kids go to a public Montessori school that's three blocks up. So it's a public school, so it's free, age 3 through 8th grade. And it's a Montessori school, which I kind of like that form of learning. Nice neighborhood, like late 40s houses. And I bought my house for $150,000. And so it's affordable. I'm like 10 minutes from work. There's never any traffic. All of your time and all of your resources, time and money, are your own. So if you want to create something, and if you're a creative person, well, I don't really know why you would be somewhere else. Because if you're creative, you might not be like a social butterfly going out and doing it. I mean, I'm pretty much just either at work or at home are my two. And so you live somewhere where you get to maximize your money and time and then focus on your project. And now you're not really getting the same type of adulation that you would get if you were in New York or LA. But, you know, as I've said several times, I don't do this for like the money or the adulation. I do it for the project.
So you were telling us off air that for that 1 year that you were traveling the East Coast and selling t-shirts, you were living in places like New York City and Boston and the happening hubs of the East Coast, and you would randomly get to sit in at the Daily Show. So share that with us, would you?
Well, yeah. So when I first started selling t-shirts, it was the summer, like spring, summer, fall of 2004. So it was like Bush v. Kerry was the big thing. But for us as college students, you know, the Daily Show was what we would watch it every night. Sometimes you would watch the rerun the next morning. And so one of our very first shirts was Jon Stewart for President. And I was selling him in Times Square. And somebody was walking by and said, oh, my boss would love that t-shirt. And I was like, well, who's your boss? She's like, Jon Stewart. She said, you should come by the taping of the show. And so I came by the taping of the show and got to sit off to the side while they were filming the show. Colbert was still on the show back then. So like sat next to me, did his little thing on the green screen, got to meet Jon Stewart afterwards, who's like a really nice guy. And you do think to yourself, oh, is that what I'm leaving behind if I'm not in New York anymore? Right. However, you know, I've now been in Des Moines for 20 years. And one of my absolutely favorite anecdotes is Scott Simon, who's the host of NPR's Weekend Edition, emailed me one time. And we've kind of developed this like internet friendship because he's ordered stuff from us, posted. And so I said, oh, thanks. And then you end up corresponding. So it's kind of neat that through the store, you end up being friends with Scott Simon, who I listen to. But then he sends me an email that said, your friend, dot, dot, dot. Older people use like email a little more creatively.
Yeah.
That's the subject line. And he starts with a hook. Then you click on it and it said, John Irving, he's got your coasters. And so Scott Simon had been in Canada interviewing the author, John Irving. And on his coffee table was this set of wooden coasters that were all about John Irving novels, but plays on coaster humor and John Irving novels.
Wow.
But they were in our font. Wow. And Scott Simon said, oh, did you get these from Reagan? And John Irvin said, yeah. You know, he went to the University of Iowa Writers College, like just like Vonnegut, and he came to Des Moines to speak one time. Coincidentally, he's my wife's favorite writer. When I met her, my wife, in the UK, she said, oh, all I know about Iowa is that John Irvin went to school there, which I didn't even know. And I was like, wow, that's all you know about Iowa. That actually makes Iowa sound pretty badass.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, yeah, if you ever came to Iowa, we'd probably hang out with John Irvin. You know, 15 years later, he's actually in Des Moines. And so I messaged the public library and I said, hey, if I can come to like a VIP meet and greet, I'll make like a special thing for John Irvin. So I made him this set of coasters, and they were, you know, things about coasters, but merged with his. So it's like, what's the sound of a water ring not leaving a water ring? Or the 13th Cider House rule is use a coaster.
Nice.
And gave it to him. My wife got to meet John Irvin. We told him the story. And then when Scott Simon went to like meet him and brought up the coasters, John Irvin like relayed this whole thing to him. Like, oh, nice. I got to meet the owner and his wife. And it was a surreal email to get, because to the point of me having never left Des Moines, essentially,
yeah,
to have made all these connections with people just by focusing on the project and individual relationships, and that you put the time in and you don't necessarily think about what's in it for you. You just kind of go from experience to experience. And when you look back, you have this kind of tremendous body of work of all these experiences.
Well, I think that's the reward to the secular sainthood, right? I mean,
yes.
I think that we certainly, when I was going to bring up Chris Cluey, who we interviewed earlier in the show, who I now have a Chris Cluey t-shirt from here because Max sent me one. But this interconnectivity of people who do decent things for decent people. And then you guys all seem to gravitate to the same corner of the earth, right? Where even if the intersection is slight enough that a man's words end up on your t-shirt, I don't know if you knew him better than that. But
yeah, we didn't know him at all. Mm-hmm. We just messaged him. But then that's the thing, is that when you have body of work behind you, he can pull up the website and you kind of speak everybody's language and can see, oh yeah, this is a legitimate place.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's, it's something, you know, somebody asked one time, it was like a business class, and they said, you have like a real, like authentic voice. How do you guys develop that? And I was like, well, being authentic probably helps.
Yeah.
It's
no
like
kidding.
I live it and breathe it. You know, it's set up not for a marketing ploy, but because of how I wanted to set it up.
Yeah. Well, so when you said that when you went to school, you thought, well, geez, I need to make some money. But then when you really started getting successful, instead of acting like maybe my cynical self would expect a person to, you said to your workers, hey, why don't you guys get a union?
Like, yeah.
Who does that?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's to the point of we just kind of like put our money where our belief structure is. I mean, you have this, you don't want your, you know, world to be like guided by fear. At the same time, you know, one time I was talking to, nobody's ever really approached us to purchase Reagan, but every once in a while you'll get approached by, you know, bankers or private equity or something like that. And so somebody from like a banker was talking to me and I explained like my theory of things and the theory of the company. And he was like, God, private equity wouldn't touch you with a 10-foot pole.
And that's for the best.
Yeah, I was like, and if I had been faster, I would have been like, I don't want to touch private equity's pole either.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I should just say that I said that. We don't, like, he's not going to know. He's not going to be listening. Then it'll make me sound like wittier at the time. But you think to yourself, this place could obviously be bigger. And people say, yeah, you could have scaled it up. And we have, you know, 10 stores, do great. And you think, yeah, you could take venture capital money, but say they come in at $5 million. Now, right now, I'm the only owner-operator. And so it's owner-founder. Venture capital comes in at $5 million. Now you have to set up a board. Well, now you're not the owner anymore. You're the officer of a corporation. And the owners are the board. And you could be on the board, et cetera, et cetera. But then you also have to realize what their motivations are. Of venture capital is going to be, you know, investment based. So they come in for $5 million, they want to get out for $10 million in 5 years. With that motivation in mind, all of their decisions and all of their input is based around monetary value, whereas mine is project based. And that's where I think you end up getting undercut, is that you get in at the beginning and it's like, well, this is great. I could take out $1 million in equity and now the business is worth $8 million and that looks good on paper. But then you get down the line and you realize, well, you're working for somebody now.
Yeah.
So you're not your own boss anymore. And that person only came in with a financial angle, not a project angle. Well, now your day-to-day has kind of changed, and the dynamic of the whole thing has changed. And for what?
And it's interesting that you're mentioning this at the moment, because I was listening to the radio the other day, and Ben or Jerry, I don't know which one of the Ben and Jerry crowd was lamenting that Unilever has taken over Ben and Jerry's.
Well, yeah, they sold it to Unilever.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, there's this regret now that the message that was so positive coming from Ben and Jerry is now being muted by this multi-corporation conglomerate, whatever, and is really killing that message.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to say no. This is almost going to sound too bizarre for it, but I heard an anecdote, and I think I've read it twice, so it's true. But Kurt Vonnegut and Joseph Heller were at a party in New York, and Joseph Heller had just released Catch-22, and it was a bestseller. And there were bankers at the party, and one of them was talking to those guys for a little while. And Kurt Vonnegut said to Joseph Heller, you know, doesn't it annoy you that those guys are going to make more in a year than we'll make in a lifetime? And Joseph Heller said, no, because I've got something they'll never have. Enough.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, is that great public speaking, great music, it's all when knowing not to play. Yeah. So it's not always know what to do and when. It's when to stop doing it. And you almost have to get where you're going, you're going to have to refuse some things. And that's the problem you get to, is I can understand the, you're at the end of the career or whatever, you have the ability to cash out, why not? And you can say to yourself, well, with all that money, I'm going to go do other good things. When you forget that actually the project you were running already does lots of little good things, and you're not making a splash with a $1 million donation, but you're doing like a $5,000 project here and $6,000 there. And just day in and day out, it puts like goodness into the world.
Well, plus you're also paying people well enough so that they can do good in their community, right? I mean, that was the thing about Carnegie, right? Carnegie or whatever. He built libraries after he had absolutely fleeced his workers. So his idea was, if I gave you something, it would be up your nose and out your hose, and then you would never do anything good in your community. Instead of, if I had a whole pile of workers that love their community, they would build a library. I wouldn't have to build a library. So you went post-patriarchal on it too. Like, you didn't say, I know better than you. I'll do better things with the money if I just screw you people out of a decent paycheck. Right? I mean, that's not a small thing to not think you're smarter than everybody else.
When you do kind of start to wonder about that, of like hustle culture and growth, of you have somebody that scales up a company and creates, you know, tons of value, quote unquote, but then along the way might pollute, fleece workers, lead to health issues, all sorts of stuff. And then you might have another movement that comes along and fixes all the stuff that that company did wrong. You kind of think, well, when you add those two things together, where are you at in the end? Are some of these giant projects that have added so much monetary value but have destroyed so much, when we have to come back through and spend 20 years cleaning up the mess, if you added positive versus negative, are you really ahead?
Yeah.
Do you really need to get like that much bigger? And what am I going to do with it? I mean, it's like, I've already got a house. I already have a car. I could get another house, even though I can barely vacuum the entire house I already have. And another car. Like, what am I going to do with that?
You know what they would do? They would get someone to vacuum the house.
Yeah, that's the other.
Yeah,
it's like,
and
then
underpay
you,
got
to hire. Yeah, then you got to hire the vacuum person, but then it's more to manage. And it's why people like me are almost hard for people to wrap their mind around. You know, I'm not comparing myself to it on scale, but somebody like Warren Buffett, where he lives in the same house in Dundee, Omaha, that he's lived in for 50 years. He has a house in South Carolina, and then that's it. And his thing on, you know, why don't you have a boat, was, then I got to manage the staff of the boat, and it's just headaches. And he's like, well, I like doing what I'm doing. And that happens to make a ton of money, but I don't even like the money. I give it all away. He doesn't do anything with the money. And then he points out the absurdities that his tax rate is lower than his secretary's tax rate. But it's so jaw-dropping to see people like that, because the ability to refuse and say, no, I've got enough. Like, this is all I need. What am I going to do with it more? And you get into the higher level politics and you realize, from a structural standpoint, America's biggest issue is that the off-ramp is so much easier than the highway you're on currently. And what I mean by that is, you know, ray guns, $8 million company, something like that. Who knows what its value? But I only take a salary. And so I'm taxed at 35%. Now, if somebody came and bought me out, gave me $4 million, well, with that $4 million, my tax rate would be cut in half. So I can go from, because it's going to be all capital gains, so you're paying maybe 15, 20%. And, you know, $4 million, you take 5% of that, you're making $200,000 a year. So in America, the tax rate is set up that you can cash out, make more money than you make currently, and pay half as much taxes, which is crazy. We reward people for not working. We reward people for not participating, for just sitting there and passively investing. Whereas the people who are in working day in and day out, you get punished for it. So then people like me seem even stranger, because in America, the easy way out is there. And right. You're rewarded for taking the easy way out. You're punished for actually participating in your community and building something.
So then the question is, well, if he's not willing to take the reward, is he living without a reward? And your answer is no, right? Because you have rewards to living the way you do.
Yeah, it's one of those things of, if you want to impress me with, like, money, it's like, well, what did the money get you? It's like, well, it got me, like, this boat. And that boat has a list price. Whereas I can look out at, like, the room I'm in now, and it's like, well, this is what not money got me. This is, like, 20 years of work and connections. And money can't buy this. You could take $9 million is about what it would take to recreate Rega. But then the odds that you'll actually succeed are infinitesimal. Somebody could take $9 million and build out 11 stores and a production facility and hire designers, and they would run it into the ground. We would still run laps around them. Because what we have built is something you cannot purchase. It is this team of people that have worked together for years and have all bought in. And it's like Voltron, you know, the sum is greater than the parts. It's a group of people who are all talented but work better together. I mean, who wouldn't want that? Because everybody will look at this place with awe because it's so hard to do. Whereas the money side, it's like, well, how'd you get the money? And now most people, it's not talent, it's circumstance. And I don't say that as like a sour grapes type of thing. It's like a fact where it's circumstance of what type of field you're in, possibly inherited, possibly right place at right time, the cryptocurrency type of thing, which is why it's really rare for somebody who has made a ton of money to go do it again.
Yeah.
The list of big level entrepreneurs who have done it once, started over and done it again is tiny. Most of them will just stop and get a job on a reality TV show or something like that. Not even thinking about Trump. I'm thinking of guys like Mark Cuban, who it's like you knock it out of the park, get a ton of money from a tech idea that wasn't even that good, and then you can buy the Boston Mavericks, which were already around, but he's never done anything again. I mean, again, nice enough guy. It's just he knows what lane he's in, and his lane is got lucky once, and now I can just ride this thing to the benefit of the American tax system and media.
Yeah, world. And the one unique thing about Mark Cuban is he does seem to notice he lives in a community, unlike other people who make a whole pile of money, stay in their lane, and then decide to screw everybody else alive. At least Mark Cuban seems to notice.
Yeah, you know, one of the good ones.
Yeah.
I want to ask, I noticed that you've got, like with Chris Cluey, you've got kind of a partnership that he's got the t-shirts that you're making. Does he have money coming back to him? And do you do that? NPR is the same thing. You've got.
Yeah. So anything that's done with an outside group or entity, we just say, hey, we can either give you a percentage of the sales or we can donate it. So with Chris Cluey's stuff, he wanted it donated to the Trevor Project. So a portion of those sales go to the Trevor Project. With NPR, we have a deal with NPR with like a licensing thing.
Yeah. They need all the money they can get right now.
Yeah. And, you know, we run the Onion's web store. And so we have like a side deal with them. We do a lot with like athletes, you know, nonprofits. So with any of those people, you just kind of reach out to them and say, oh, hey, we can take that, make it into a shirt, and we can either give you a percentage or donate a percentage.
That's going to be a headache. Keeping all that.
Oh,
straight.
Yeah. No, I mean, you can do a lot with Excel. It's not too tough. I mean, you have to pull the reports and things like that, but it's, not anything other places don't do. We just do it in a slightly more interesting way.
Yeah. For slightly better reasons.
Yeah. I mean, we're working with people that we want to work with. Our main business is, you know, the store. So after the like Charlie Kirk shooting, you know, we said nothing about it. We had no Charlie Kirk product. We had never said anything about him before he was shot or after he was shot. It didn't, I mean, he wasn't somebody that really like came into our worldview before or after. But there's kind of this like knee jerk reaction of some people on the right to come after anybody on the left and say this. So you got like a lot of angry messages.
Really?
From people.
Even though you've never had a comment about Charlie Kirk.
Yeah. I think people were just kind of like itching to like say something. And so we posted just a reminder. It's like, well, you can really only cancel somebody if you have leverage over them. And that's, you know, the sad thing that somebody Jimmy Kimmel finds himself in is you spend your whole year or your whole life making so much content, but you are working for this media entity. And they remind you, as they did Stephen Colbert, as Comedy Central will The Daily Show, that, no, you are an employee, and you can get removed. Like, you don't have a right to be here.
Right.
And it's frustrating, but that's what the money's for. Jimmy Kimmel went to work for ABC. He didn't like hustle through and do stand up. I'm not saying he deserved to be canceled. I think it's ridiculous. But
no, but he made it. I was a broadcaster. He made an agreement on certain terms, which he can sue if they violated, but it's still just a business transaction.
Yeah. Whereas for us, we've remained small and you don't have the reach of a Jimmy Kimmel. You don't have like the star power, but we have total control.
Yeah.
And so we posted something just like, hey, attention assholes, you can try to cancel us all you want, but 80% of our revenue comes from individual customers. Of our corporate clients, which is 20% of our revenue, no client is more than 3% of our revenue. So yeah, you can go on a tear, but you have no leverage over us.
Yeah.
I say you start a boycott movement and one of our bigger corporate clients pulls because they don't want to be associated with us. Well, we've lost 1% of top line revenue and we're in kind of a low margin business. I couldn't give a shit. It's just like, I don't care. I mean, you're just screaming into the void at that point. And you're kind of like, I want to talk to the manager. I am the manager.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you feel bad for people who realize that they've done all this work and then are thrown to the side by corporate America. But it's like, what did you expect? A kinder, gentler corporate America that was going to care about your feelings or your project? That's not the equation for them. It's money in, money out. Whereas mine has been a slow, expensive process. When you would talk to VCs, their thing was always, oh my God, you're too, I'm trying to think of what their phrase was, but it's like, you're too cost heavy. You got all these physical stores. You got all these people. You have all the equipment, all the production. You got to get rid of that. Like, outsource production to the cheapest possible place you can find and go online only. It's all direct to consumer. That's the future. But the expense of physical stores and the production is just the cost to control. The physical store is one of the only places not controlled by the algorithm. This is one of the last bastions of getting just random people coming in that the robot didn't send our way. So even if you're online only, direct to consumer, well, you will find that customer acquisition is now really expensive because the internet is run by like 3 or 4 big companies.
Right.
And they set all the pricing. And the only way you meet people is through them. And they can tell you how much it costs to meet people. And then with our production, we couldn't run the company if we didn't handle our own production. We can get shirts out within an hour into the store. But we could also toggle up inventory. So we don't have to get over inventoried. We can do a quick release shirt and just print 10 of them. And then if it sells well, we print 100 the next day or 1,000 the next day. And so you get this kind of throwaway advice, which probably sounds good in like a boardroom somewhere or like a presentation, but it's totally meaningless as to what we do. And the nice thing for us anyway is there's not a lot of direct competition because other people are often taking shitty advice.
Yeah.
So most of our competitors have taken all of this terrible advice. They've outsourced their production. They haven't focused on physical stores and authenticity and real connections. And we have. And the hard thing about it is that it's kind of like the Pink Floyd song Time. Like, one day you'll find 10 years have got behind you.
Yeah.
No one told you when to run. You missed the starting gun. You won't see how far apart you are from somebody on decision-making for a decade or 20 years. And we're here 20 years down the road, and people wonder how we did it. And it's that slow and steady sticking to what we do day in and day out and not wavering from that. And you find the people that wavered for a reason in the beginning. They got some money out of it. They got X, Y, Z. But then 10 years later, you wake up and you wonder where the whole thing went.
Your stores. So I was here about 3 or 4 months ago for the National Forensic League National Speech and Debate National Competitions.
Oh, yeah.
I was one of the judges, which is one of my favorite things to do. Plus, my son is a coach and my grandkids participate. So what was really fun was I am in a building with some of the smartest, most articulate young people I have ever met in my life. And it was like watching ants move down the hill as they all came to Reagan. Right? I mean, this store has it has almost a folklorish reality for, we say nerd in my family as a compliment.
Oh, yeah.
For this really cool bunch of kids, but one of the absolute must-dos was coming to Reagan.
Yeah.
And that was just really fun. And then I'm in here with a ton of kids, and they're, you know, going shirt crazy and sticker crazy. And
dorks are kind of like our prime demographic.
Yeah.
Mainly because we're all dorks.
Yeah. Well, that's fair enough.
Four dorks by dorks.
But so now you're in Chicago. So is it that same dork thing in Chicago? I mean, are there a million dorks there? Were there only 100,000 here? Or
yeah, you kind of find, there's like this, we've been able to blend a lot of a lot. So the store is interesting because it's kind of random of you have some of the most left-wing messages. So, for example, we probably have more uteri on t-shirts than any store in America. You have a shirt that says the GOP creating government small enough to fit inside your vagina. And we also have a licensing deal with Bush Light. I mean, Iowa State, there's tailgating merchandise. And so the blend of things is we don't talk down to like anybody. So even with, you know, I did state speech, Alex, who's our like director of content, did state speech. So both of us were in group improv, although she made it to all state and I only made it to sub state.
So
is
that
sad how it's like, it's been,
get her on the show.
I know,
yeah.
Which is sad that it's like 25 years and I'm still like, God, I can't.
It hurts.
I remember our skit. I remember what we should have done better, but anyway,
wow.
But you also don't make it like, this is a one-dimensional entity where it's only progressivism and it's only stuff about band and speech. You also know that, well, I grew up in a little town, so I did theater, but also played football and like football. And you can have this multi-dimensional thing. And yeah. So you'll have people that come in for, you know, Bush Light and tailgate stuff, real tree camo, MAGA hat types, and they'll buy things from us and be like, I don't like a lot of the stuff in here. But that's the thing about a space is that if you make it funny and you make the space entertaining, you can tell people all sorts of things that they wouldn't be receptive to if you tell them in the right way. And I do think there is, it's not necessarily like an intelligence on the side of the store that's not there. It's that the store doesn't insult other people's intelligence. The store puts out this wide variety of product, which isn't pandering to everybody. It all kind of hangs together as, you know, funny Midwestern progressive. But it also doesn't pigeonhole people to say like, oh, well, the trans rights people aren't going to want to shop in a store with football stuff. And the band kids aren't going to want to shop in a store with Bush Light stuff. It's realizing that most people are multidimensional.
Yes.
And have a variety of interests.
Yeah.
And it's realizing that, no, those things are all mixed up together. And I think so it's not necessarily the store did anything that wasn't done before, but just doesn't insult other people's intelligence in that way.
And you mentioned being involved with speech. I'm really curious. You've got such great messages on so many of the products that you have. Who develops that material? You were talking about comedy. Who develops these messages for the shirts?
Yeah, so we have like a design team here where we sit out on the mezzanine. But the design team's not huge. There's only, you know, 3 full-time designers, which always surprises people when they see the amount of output we have. But all the stores are connected through Slack. And so store managers, assistant managers, employees, everybody can suggest ideas. So with all the stores, we say, hey, just post anything you want. So our Slack channel is kind of like a closed social media network. And the idea is you never know where ideas are going to come from. So just post anything that's on your mind. And somebody may post one thing. Like one of my favorite examples is in our manager meeting, our Cedar Rapids manager said, oh, I was almost going to call in sick today because I was up all night playing Zelda. But then my mom told me I should probably go to work. That calling in because you were up all night playing video games isn't like an excuse. And I like, we kind of laughed and we were like, oh, well, thanks for showing up. And then somebody else said like, oh, I've been playing a ton of Zelda too. We're like, oh, that's fine. And then we all talked about Zelda for a little bit. And then somebody said, oh, we should do something about Zelda. And other people in like the warehouse who were on Slack also were like, oh yeah, we were up like all night playing Zelda. And then we found out it was like a thing. A lot of people were like into work because they'd been up all night playing Zelda. So we made a shirt that said, I paused Zelda to be here. And it was like our most popular shirt that month. And it really came from just kind of like casual chit chat. The person brought it up because they, not for shirt material, but just talking about things. And then other than you see these connections. And so any of the ideas when people will say, well, who came up with that one? Like, well, we can retrace our steps and say, well, that person had the idea for that topic, but they only had that because we were talking about something else. And then this other person suggested this way of phrasing it, and this other person laid it out. You don't, you know, the starting wage here is the starting wage. So there's no difference in graphic designer, printer, floor staff. Because having done all the jobs, I'm like, well, there's no way to break them down and rank them as which one's more important. You're not able to print anything without the designers. You're not able to sell anything without the printers. You're not able to run the stores without the floor staff. So why create some sort of hierarchy? I had a kid who said, oh, do I get a raise because I have a design degree? It's like, no. Nobody told you to get a design degree. It's like, I don't have a design degree. It's that trying to emphasize to people that you don't have to be a designer to have ideas. And part of it is not getting people who have good ideas. Part of it on us is, well, how do we draw ideas out from people? And if you're not getting enough ideas from employees, it may not be the employee's fault. It may be that you haven't set up an environment to collect ideas properly. And it can be annoying if you think to yourself, well, we have the suggestion box and we're not getting any ideas. But you realize, well, some people like to do it in person. Some people like to do it online. You only have who's here. You need to maximize everybody's time and brain power. And so you really need to get as much information out of people as possible. And you have to have three or four different ways to collect ideas from the people who are here.
So to me, it also seems to make absolute sense. And I'm listening to you and staring at you almost in constant disbelief. Because it almost is like you don't realize, and I, forgive me for this, but you almost like you don't realize how absolutely unique you are to think that there isn't a whole world out there where people absolutely don't want to get paid the same as the person running the cash machine. And that person is supposed to not have ideas. And I have to work for a place where I'm more valuable than somebody else. And it's like you don't even get that.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the exact opposite type of person we look for, is the gatekeeper who is, they're more going to be wrapped up in like pay and titles and rank and control. And it's, well, I'm in control of the design files. I have the final say over how the company logo is used, and you can give input, but it has to come through me in these proper channels. Whereas ours just puts a lot of faith in a lot of people, and you kind of blow the whole thing wide open and say, well, here's the general like channels that it goes through. But any of these group of people get to make the decision of what goes out. And it's not even me as the final sign-off on it. The group of four or five of us at the top, if any one of them says, like, yeah, let's just make that, well, then it gets made. So you're not waiting on one person. And most of our designers have started in production first. And people will say, well, do you have a design position open? It's like, no, but you could work in production or the floor. Now, the reason why I like that is that then you're approaching it knowing how we actually make money.
Yeah.
you work in the floor and you see what people buy and why. And then when you work in production, you realize how screen printing works and why a two-color shirt is more expensive to make than a one-color shirt and how to set up a screen. And you leave the world of theoretical design and you enter the world of, well, this is how design actually becomes product. And we don't make money by good design. We make money by people buying things from us.
Yeah.
You're not hired for your design potential. You're hired for your ability to fit into this like group of people. And it's like, yeah, if you are going somewhere because you want a certain title and a certain rank and a certain pay rate and a certain amount of like constant adulation and ass kissing, well, yeah, this is probably not the place for you. If you want to join something where everybody's input is valued and you are building something that's going to be way more impressive than a regular design firm, then yeah, come here. The downside is there's like no rank in ass kissing. It's like you're not going to say, I'm above this person and I'm friends with this guy. It's like everyone has to pull their weight, me included. And that as soon as things start getting too siloed is when you start moving slowly. And we're in the world where speed above all else, you have to get stuff out fast. And the biggest advantage for us is most companies operate in this like siloed, uncreative mindset. And they move so slowly that you just run circles around them. And they'll ask us, like we get hired by companies all the time and say, well, we want to move faster. And you just ask them, like, well, who's in charge of approving product? Well, it goes to this person, then to this person, then to this person. And you're like, well, can that happen in a 3-hour process? Well, yeah, if they're all in the office, sure.
Wow.
How often are they all in the office together? Well, every once in a while. It's like, well, then there's no point to you even trying to replicate what we do, because it's structurally impossible for you to put product out with that type of setup.
You know, I was here, as I said, a few months ago, and now it's all clear to me. There was a shirt down there, and you only had smalls, and I wanted it for my husband, and it said something to the effect of, everything's a conspiracy theory when you don't know how anything works, right?
Yeah.
And that is so my husband, and I wanted the shirt so bad, and I came up back, and I said, do you have any more of these up back? And she said, no. So then we had the exodus of kids that wanted to come back down here from the debate, so we came down 2 days later, and you had the shirt in my husband's size.
Yeah.
I think it was, so somebody printed it.
Yeah.
That's what happened. That's
Are you able to do, like, special requests like that?
No,
like, hey, I'm going to be out of town for 2 days.
Yeah,
I
mean,
do one?
They just realized they were out of them, I think.
Yeah, with that one we get, there's, like, new product that arrives into the store, like, every 2 days. So if you come, it's like the sizes will get replenished. We also do special requests for people. I mean, people will suggest, you know, similar to Chris Cluey, it was... Somebody pinged us on Blue Sky, I think, and we just messaged him and said, oh, these are great quotes. We liked you when you were at the Vikings, yada, yada, yada. If you want us to make them, let us know. And that's how those shirts got made. And you might have somebody that gives us a suggestion over the internet. We're like, yeah, we like it. Well, we'll make that. Do you want a percentage? Do you want us to donate a percentage? And they'll say, yeah, just donate a percentage. And it's all pretty casual. We're not then going to send them like a DocuSign or something like that.
Yeah.
We're not going to slow down the process. It doesn't go through legal. Now you could say, well, but without a contract, yada, yada, yada. And you're like, well, yeah. With American case law, if you've got an email exchange and it's all pretty clear, that's essentially a contract. Sometimes the legal department is involved just because they're in-house counsel and they're employed and they want to feel like they're doing something. So they go through and like read documents for you. But it's all this performative necessity. It's like, I need to look like I'm... And you had that all the time in meetings with sometimes people who don't really do much will just ask questions and make suggestions because they want to make it seem like they're doing something. And those are the worst types of people to have in your organization because they kind of... The people who work really hard on things will take those questions like, oh, I should really want to answer that. And you're like, no. That person, like Dennis, he doesn't actually need an answer. He just asks questions to make it look like he does something. And then he makes suggestions, and he actually hasn't thought through it. Same type of thing. He just wants to say enough that we think he was there and he's, like, contributing, but he's never going to do shit. He's on his way out. Because once you identify them, you push them off to the side. And the way you get rid of those people's ideas is you're like, that's a great idea, Dennis. You can be in charge of that. And then it never gets done. And you don't have to tell them no. You just know that's the type of person who doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
And you just want people who are forward-moving and want to do something. And you're not holding things up. it's, yeah, we can't do all of it right now, but let's just get 75% of the way there, get the wagon train moving, and then we'll fill in that last 25%.
I think that's your next shirt. Oh, no, that's Dennis. He doesn't deserve it.
And if you pull people off to the side and tell them that, you're like, oh, hey, listen, you're great. I know that person's question irritated you, but don't worry. I put absolutely zero faith in what that person says, whereas I put all the faith in what you do. So just don't let them bother you. I'll work on that person. And they're like, oh, that makes me feel better.
So the argument could be made, you had an upbringing that was, you know, a parent that was a lawyer and a parent that was an engineer, and you were encouraged to go to a great school. And so that gave you a leg up from kids who don't have those things, grow up in foster care, and they're, you know, and there's a tough things for people all over the world. Is there a sort of a universal ethical feeling you have that you can spread out to anybody anywhere? Or is that a question you
would say? Oh, yeah. I always say that my memoir would be like the most boring book, because it's like, boy from upper middle class family, stable, supportive, grew up in a little town, also stable and supportive. All of my teachers were like, you're going to do great things. Gets given every single opportunity and does great things. It's like, surprise. Yeah. And that's what people struggle with, is they'll say, well, I've worked for what I've had, et cetera, et cetera. You're like, yeah, I'm not saying I haven't worked. I'm just saying every door was open to me.
Yeah.
I could pick which path I wanted. And I picked the path that I was, you know, going to succeed in most likely. I got to pick the type of business, that type of thing. And so you recognize that you've like had every advantage, but it's also, even somebody like me, it's good to recognize what you didn't do. You know, a friend of mine from Penn suggested selling the shirts. So it wasn't even my idea. A friend of mine from high school taught me how to screen print. Another friend of mine from high school gave me the idea to open a store. My parents provided free housing when I moved back. Well, those are four pretty major things.
Yeah,
and people kind of gloss over that, of how much they've done. And I think my mom being a mechanical engineer is one of those things of, even in like the upper middle class world, you remember that when she moved to Iowa, she was one of three female mechanical engineers. Had come from General Motors, where she was the only mechanical engineer. Was the first female Republican page, like in D.C. in history. So when she was a page, there were two female pages of several hundred pages in D.C. And you instinctively kind of grow up with this knowledge that you're not always competing against everybody. You're competing against just the people who have been selected for the game. And that we've ignored this whole other wing of people. And I think that's kind of what, like, my mom probably impressed upon me, was that there is this built-in advantage, you know, people like me. And even if, like, leave race out of it. Our, you know, high school football team, we made it to, like, the state semifinals, you know, freshman year. And you're like, my God, we're the second best team in the state. In Class A. And then there's 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A, 5A. And you're kind of like, well, but didn't we kind of adjust the competition to suit you? And you're not really the second best in the state. You're probably not even in the top 20, because a 5A school would have steamrolled you. Say you're the best 5A school in Iowa. Well, you're not the best Division I. There's better colleges, then there's pro teams. It's that realization that all you really have are these like tools that you have been given. And it's that, it's tricky to explain, because it's kind of like bifurcated. Because if you are, you know, conscientious and hardworking, you think to yourself, well, that will get me far enough. But really only in an environment that values that type of stuff. So I think it's two-sided. If you want to go in, show up, work, put in effort. But if you're working in a place that doesn't reward those things, instead rewards nepotism or ass-kissing, well, then move to somewhere else. And find somewhere else. And know that there's really no one clear path. Like when people look at back at the chart of this company, they'll be like, oh, how did you do it? And you're like, well, you're just wandering out into a field full of fence posts in pitch darkness. And you bump into some posts, and then you move and bump into another one and then move. And it's like Plinko. And you just hope that none of those fence posts injures you badly enough that you're down for the count. And then when you look back on it, you can see this winding path that you took, but it's just circumstance to circumstance. There's sometimes no overcoming some circumstances. Like, everything's hard work and circumstance. And if the circumstances swamp your boat, that's it. There's anything from, like, health, greater economics. There's lots of forces that are out of your control. All you can really do is go and show up and do what's in your control every day.
I've got to compare you to Jimmy Kimmel right now.
Only because it's topical. Yeah, let's be real.
Yeah, right. But what Jimmy Kimmel, I bet, didn't count on was a million people canceling their Disney subscription, right? And what he didn't count on was that he was going to matter to so many little guys, that the little guys were actually going to have his back one day. And I'm not putting Jimmy Kimmel down for probably never thinking of that, but that's how he got saved, right? That's how he got his job back, was that a whole pile of people that nobody really cares about cared about him, or at least not to an enormous degree more than $15.99 a month, right?
Yeah.
But what I'm curious about you, and I promise not to test you about this anymore, is how from all of that, having the ability to have a home that encouraged you, say, you didn't become a boss, that you didn't become, you know, a bastard. You didn't say, this is my company.
Yeah.
You know, how did you stay a secular saint?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because, again, to the point earlier of, like, the off-ramp is easy. I mean, it's easy to lose your temper. It's hard to maintain control. If you think about, well, what is a man? A man is, and it's not even a man, it's like a woman. What people find irritating about adults are childlike qualities, temper tantrums, inability to follow through, that type of stuff, which means that what people like is dependability. And you just start to realize that what you need above all else is dependability. Somebody asked me, like, well, what would be your advice for running a business? And I'm like, just reply to your emails. And people think I'm joking, but it's like, no, you just show up every day, do what you can do, clear out all the emails. You are building this sense of dependability. And it's kind of tricky because I think part of it is, like, the personality side. But the other part is, like, thinking about what your anchors are. And what your anchor is, like, well, who do you respect in the world and why? And if you think about it from that, then you remove yourself from it. You say, well, at the end of the day, here's the people I really like. And I've always noticed that the people I really liked weren't the people who made the most money. They were the people who did, like, the coolest work. He said, well, if that's what I respect about them, that's going to be, at the end of the day, what I respect about me. And so it always comes down to, like, body of work. And it's what gets you the best body of work. Now, you can flip the whole thing around and say, like, well, you're not an asshole boss. You're, like, just a nice guy. But I would look at it from the business side of it and say, oh, but actually, I'm singularly results driven. All I care about is, like, the best possible product. And you don't get that product by, like, screaming at people. This isn't, like, my theory. There was, like, a group of Israeli doctors, and they found that when one doctor was rude to another doctor, that doctor's performance seemed to drop afterwards. Crazily enough, the other doctors who had observed that behavior, their performance also dropped. And so they brought it into a lab, and they started testing people. And they would give them a test of 10 questions. And then they would do something like, when you were on your way to your lab, the lab, somebody would bump into you and then scream at you in the hallway. Then they would test you. And they found your performance on the test dropped, having gotten screamed at for something totally unrelated to the test. Then they found that if you observed somebody getting screamed at, that your performance also dropped. So if you're a manager at Reagan and your task is to maximize performance for profit, well, then we know that screaming at people hurts performance, which hurts profit. So you're not screaming at people because we don't want to be mean. You're not screaming at people because not screaming at people gets the most out of the employees, and getting the most out of the employees furthers the project. So that's what's so surreal to me, isn't that we're an outlier, and I'm not doing this for, like, altruism. I'm not being nice to people in the company just for the sake of being nice to people in the company. We're being nice to people and conscientious because then we get the most back. We get the best performance out of employees. We get the most loyalty from customers when you are actually engaged with the community. So it all financially makes sense, which is why it's jaw-dropping to me that this model seems so strange, because it's so insanely successful,
yeah,
but also founded in research that is not a secret. I mean, these are studies that are available to everybody, but bosses would rather focus on things like grind culture and hustle culture rather than say, no. You don't set your day as infinity hours. You say, we only have 7 hours. We're going to respect your time outside of work. And there's a hard stop at this time. Well, then everybody actually works during work. And you don't have these fucking stupid meetings all day. Because the clock is running. Like, we start the clock and the clock ends. Then it's a matter of, here's what we need to do today. And you arrange your day around getting that stuff done. And all the superfluous meetings with 8 people and... all that stuff gets cut to the wayside because you say, no, we have to get to this point by 4:45. And it's like pencils down. And then you see these other companies that waste time in meetings during the day. And then they're sending us Slack messages at like 9:15 about t-shirts. And you're just like, God, I feel bad for you. You could do this job during your hours, but your company is set up pointlessly. And the employees get ground down and they feel like the company doesn't respect my time. And then they don't respect the company's time. And so it's not set up for secular sainthood. It's set up for success in the capitalist world. But fuck, being nice to people is good for business. For anybody.
Living decently in an indecent time is good for business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. You know, you might not knock it out of the park, but... you got to understand that the people you observe from a distance that have like $10 million, well, again, they got it mostly through circumstance. And who knows how? You can't set up your life on that side. And especially when those people go around and give advice and it's somebody that started a tech company, right place at the right time, got bought out for $10 million, and then writes a book about how they were successful.
Yeah.
And I'm like, at what?
Yeah,
you ran
no kidding.
A company for 3 years and then you cashed out. And now you just invest. You're this tiny sliver of the population. Your advice is useless.
Yeah, like, isn't that a fact?
To almost everybody. But, you know, people equate money with success because it's an easy marker. And everybody always likes to hear that, you know, Ray Gunn's a $12 million company. And that sounds impressive from a certain standpoint. And you really have to tell people that it's like, it's just as hard now as it was in the beginning. Still
so when can we get your book on the art of the deal? Because your book is better for the real deal, right? So,
but that's why, you know, that kind of stuff gets overlooked. And to your point of, you know, where are you going to learn from? You're sometimes looking at like the wrong people. You're looking at these marquee names and saying, well, what does that person think about it? As if they have any more knowledge than the people around you. And it's that realization that there's so many connections and stories you can make locally. That this idea of, this is like kind of off on a tangent, but this idea of like, well, I need like me time. And the idea that to, you know, better yourself or self-care, you need to turn inward and focus on yourself. It's like, well, no, actually you're doing the opposite. Like you need to focus outward. Just like go to a coffee shop and make conversation. Join an organization. Donate your time. As soon as you are part of a bigger entity that is doing something positive, a company, an organization, a community group, a community in general, a neighborhood group. That's what like humans need.
Yes.
It feeds everything inside of you. There is no replicating that in the digital space or anywhere. There is no way to short circuit that. You are a member of this like group of other humans. Just wake up and realize there's no other place that you can be right now. There's no other time period you can be right now. All you can do is make the most of what you have currently. And once you realize that, then you realize it's all just a set of day-to-day experiences. You're not leaving any of this stuff behind. Why not just do something that you enjoy doing day in and day out?
Right. So for people who can't get to the Midwest and have this wonderful experience, they can go online. So how do people do that?
Yeah. So you can find us just by Googling Raygun or raygunsite.com. So not to knock the internet for anybody who wants to shop on the internet. You certainly can, but the in-store experience just blows the internet out of the water.
Well, and I am so glad that you did have the great internet presence that you do, because I learned about it. And now I'm here, and I am as excited as can be. And I don't mean to, like, cut the interview short. We're a little over time now. like I honestly could stay here and talk to you for a long, long, long time because you fascinate me. I really enjoy listening to you, but we also don't want to take away too much of your time. I cannot thank you enough for one, agreeing to be interviewed for our podcast, and two, inviting us to this beautiful space. It is a thrill for me. It really is.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for coming, and thanks for inviting me on.
Thanks for listening to Sacred Legions, hosted by Max Goler and Pat LaMarche. Original music by Jamie Calland. To hear archived episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service. You will learn more about people behaving decently in indecent times and about the nonprofit organizations they support. Don't forget to check out our merchandise shop. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions, LLC.